Order the House Judiciary Committee at 1:15. We have two items of business. One very brief item is certainly we've discussed enough HJR 5, that is the conscience, freedom of conscience bill that has been discussed in here on several occasions, and I would like to, if possible, have a motion to move that out of committee. And
Chairman?
It is up or down? Yes, Representative.
I would move HJR 5 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Object for purpose clarification. I thought we already had a vote on this, sir.
Wait, pardon?
Did we have a vote on it?
No, not to move it out of committee. We did had a vote on it, but it didn't pass.
Oh, so do we have to rescind our other action?
No, we just bring it back up. It didn't pass out of the door.
This is the...
This is the freedom of conscience.
Martin's Constitution Amendment. Okay, I withdraw my objection. Mr. Chairman.
The objection has been withdrawn. Any other? Hearing none. The bill is removed from committee. And that brings us to HB 406. This is sometimes referred to as a subsistence bill. We have had some hearings on it already. We have a couple of others that I think are going to be very germane to the subject, and obviously as the audience would indicate, you're all here in eager anticipation. The first person we have to give us a presentation is former Attorney General Charlie Cole. General Cole, would you please come forward and give us your input on this issue? Oh, for the record, we have a full house.
The
table.
With the permission of the chairman, I'd like Byron Malott to join.
Certainly.
Me.
Certainly.
And he's promised to hold my hat, so.
I would ask if you are going to talk back and forth, that for the record, if each of you would identify yourself so that when the minutes are taken, they'll know who's saying what.
Ask them to please forgive us our eating.
I've been requested to ask your forgiveness as well as the audience for some people who have been, as you know, sometimes committee functions run into other committee functions, and so they are doing one of their functions right now in sustenance. Representative Cole, excuse me, Attorney General Cole.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back, testifying again. Thank you for affording me the opportunity to appear here together with Byron Malott. Together we served on the Subsistence Task Force and collectively drafted a proposed constitutional amendment and proposed legislation. And with your permission, today I would like to take a moment and express some background to the problem as we saw it when the task force began its deliberations. I have brought prepared and brought here today and placed on the wall a map. It purports to depict the lay of the land. The lands marked in yellow with black crosshatching are lands owned by the state of Alaska. The other lands in various colors are lands owned by the United States of America. In general, the United States in Alaska owns approximately 245 million acres. The state of Alaska owns approximately 103 million acres. Native corporations own approximately 44 million acres. Now, I think the starting point with respect to this map and the discussion today lies with the powers of the United States to deal with the lands which it owns in Alaska. The United States Supreme Court has said in several cases, but most recently in Kleppe versus the United States, which I'm sure most of you have read, if not all of you, is that the powers of the United States under the Property Clause to deal with these lands are virtually unlimited. The court, speaking through Justice Marshall, said almost those precise words in the Kleppe case. Somewhat left open in that case was the extraterritorial
it's easy for you to say.
Powers of the United States over lands not owned by it. But it is clear through a long series of decisions of the United States Supreme Court that the United States has, as I say, virtually unlimited powers over those lands, number one, and it owns those lands and can legislate with respect to those lands in two capacities. One, as a landowner of those lands, it owns those lands, and it has what, you know, we would customarily assume to be the powers of any landowner over those lands. As the court has said, it may restrict the people who enter upon those lands, and it may qualify their rights to enter upon those lands and to occupy them. And it also has the power over those lands as a sovereign, you know, exercising police powers over those lands. So it has very broad powers over those lands. Now, secondly, the state of Alaska, of course, by the same general token, has powers over the lands it owns. And the state, acting through the legislature and its agencies of the state, has exercised those powers to regulate the taking of fish and game on those lands owned by the state. In addition, there's two things which I think should be mentioned with respect to the various powers of the sovereigns dealing with the lands shown on that board. And one of them is, as the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska has said, the state of Alaska has the power to manage fish and game on federal lands, except where the exercise of the state's power over those lands conflicts with federal action. And the Alaska Supreme Court said that in the Totemoff case, decided in 1995. And so, although the state does have powers over fish and game over the federal lands, it may not exercise those powers in conflict with the exercise of federal power over its land. That's number one. Number two, to keep in mind with respect to these powers, is the fact that although one Court of Appeals has said left open in the Kleppe case was the extraterritoriality powers of the United States, it's clear that the United States has the power to exercise its powers under the property clause over lands not owned by it, lands and waters not owned by it, to the extent that the exercise of those powers are necessary to effectuate policies underlying federal actions. Very important. The case is Minnesota versus Block in the Eighth Circuit. So where does that get us today? Well, where are we? Well, we know that the United States, acting under the powers, the property clause, and purportedly acting under the powers of the Commerce Clause and maybe the power to regulate Indian affairs. I think those powers are a little thin to the extent they purport to support ANILCA. But Congress has said, look, on these lands, rural residents shall have a power in the taking of fish and game for subsistence purposes, a priority to for that purpose. And the federal government has also said, well, I'll make you a deal. You know, if you want to grant a general power to granting a by general legislation to grant the power to grant priority to rural residents for the taking of fish and game for subsistence purposes, we'll let you do it. You can do it. The only thing you have to do to manage fish and game on federal lands is to grant this priority to rural residents. And that's where we are today, I'd say. Well, it worked, as you know, pretty well for a while. And then the Alaska Supreme Court said, oh, by the way, you can't grant that special rights, if you will, to rural residents under the Alaska Constitution. And so it struck down Alaska's management of fish and game on federal land. The whole problem in somewhat is complicated by the decision of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in the Katie John case. And it held that in that case that whereby previously the state had had the power and the acknowledged power to manage fisheries, the Court of Appeals said in that case, well, in order to really effectuate the rural priority or the management of fish, we have to figure out, you know, if you will, a power of the United States to manage fish in navigable waters. And so the court came up with the bright idea, the learned court, I might say. I wanted to give the court its due, that the federal government has reserved water rights in its lands, where those navigable waters or you might say contiguous or run through federal lands. And that was a sort of a shock, if you will. It was a shock to me, and I'm sure to many others, is that suddenly, with that case, we have the power being granted to the United States to essentially manage fishing in all navigable waters in the state. Now you say, wait a minute, Mr. Cole, don't get ahead of yourself. The Court of Appeals said, well, we only have that power in the United States to the extent that these waters are adjacent or contiguous to federal lands. Okay. Well, if you look at that map, you will see the vast reaches of that power to regulate fisheries in navigable waters within the boundaries of the state of Alaska. The United States, by virtue of that decision, can regulate fishing in vast areas of the state, as shown there. But you see, the exercise of that power does not simply stop in those colored areas, areas colored other than yellow, because clearly, you know, the federal government will say, well, for us to effectively regulate subsistence fishing in these areas colored other than yellow, we must regulate fishing along the entire stream of the Yukon River, and the various other main water arteries throughout the state. I mean, obviously, you know they will say that at the first proverbial rattle out of the can. You know too that exercising the powers granted the United States under the Block case, I mean, are going to say why these caribou herds cross from that pink lands over there to the yellow back and forth, and we can't allow the state of Alaska to be managing the caribou herds over there in those yellow lands, because when we come back, the herds will be decimated when they come back over to those colored areas, areas colored other than yellow, and there won't be anything left, and that will impact adversely upon the subsistence rights management. And they will say the same thing with fishing. They say, well, we can't allow all this fishing to be taken down at the mouth of the Yukon. How can we guarantee a priority to fishing up in the Porcupine area while you've intercepted all of the salmon down at the mouth of the Yukon? So that's where we are today. And the issue is, as I say, for this legislature, for the people of this state, is to say, do we want to accept the federal government's offer to regain management of fish and game in Alaska, or don't we? Because, in essence, we have to accept, in my view, the offer of the United States and the Ranilka, and essentially, you know, capitulate, if we want that. But there is no pressure on this legislature, a legal pressure, for the state to accept that offer. It may do it, and it may not. That's a decision left to the people of the state of Alaska. Now, what did we do in the task force when we faced these issues? Well, at least I am not speaking for the legislature at this view. One, I thought it was vital that the state regain management of fish and game. I mean, I thought that was the central proposition, that we had to get it back. I mean, that was the statehood battle, to get it back. And now we're in danger of not only losing it on federal lands, but if my view is correct, and I think it is, we're in danger of losing it throughout all lands in the state of Alaska. That's number one. Number two is, on the task force, I was concerned that if we ever lost it, we may never get it back. You'll recall that in the Stevens Amendments, there is a statutory right to regain management. Now, that's in the Stevens Amendments. It's not clear otherwise that we can, if we let this opportunity pass by today, that we can say, well, we will change our mind next year and get it back. Because I'm not certain that we can get it back next year if we should change our mind. This may be a fleeting opportunity, and perhaps in our lifetimes, certainly maybe mine, maybe not Mr. Berkowitz's, we may never have another opportunity to get it back. This may be it. So the decision which you people face, you know, has consequences. Another view I had when I was on the task force is, you know, I had the sense that may, you know, historically I've had the sense that really Blackstone was probably right. You know, possession is 9 points of the law in the broad sense. And what does that mean in this context? Well, I'll tell you what it means in this context. If we get management back, then we can have the opportunity to make changes in the future to Anilka that we think we would like to see. We can expand the scope of our management powers, maybe slowly, maybe imperceptibly, but we can work to that end. But we are in control with respect to the management at that time. Now, what's the converse of that? Well, the converse of that is if we don't get it back now, then the federal government is in control. See? And the federal government will then seek to expand its powers, you know, creeping powers. We know that. We've all been subject to creeping federal powers. And they will continue to expand those powers. They will solidify their hold on those powers. And as I say, we may lose essentially these rights forever. So what did we do in the task force? Do you want to say something? So, you know, what we did, we said, look, our fundamental approach was that it will be very hard, if not impossible, to make major changes in the rural priority under Anilka. I didn't think that it would be possible for us to repeal or amend the basic rural priority. So I said, and others on the task force said, well, look, there's some really fundamental flaws in ANILCA that we think that we can change legislatively, like deference to state court actions. We lost that issue in the Court of Appeals. We thought we wanted to get that back because we thought it was important. And we wanted to clarify the definitions of rural. And we wanted to clarify the non-definitions, if you will, of customary and traditional. So, you know, we came up with proposed amendments for those purposes. And we recognized that it would be necessary to amend the Constitution in order to effect legislation complying with the ANILCA. So we proposed a constitutional amendment. We left out of that constitutional amendment the word rural. We gave the power to the legislature to say, you can grant a priority for the taking of fish and game for subsistence purposes and uses based on place of residence. But we didn't enshrine rural into the Constitution, we left it out. And that is what we proposed to the legislature. We recognized that our work product was not perfect, that there would be other views, but we thought it was a workable proposition. And Senator Stevens, you might say, was successful in putting those amendments into ANILCA. And it's very important, in my view, that if we do not regain management pursuant to the Stevens amendments, that we will lose those highly beneficial amendments to ANILCA. I mean, they're conditioned, you know, on acceptance by the state of Alaska to regain management. But I don't think people generally recognize, I mean, how important that deference is to state administrative actions is. It's a highly important and beneficial provision. And so there are others. Now, what's the downside that you people face? Well, look, I mean, we know that there's not easy to amend the Alaska Constitution to strip away these principles of equality which are contained there. I felt myself that restraint. I mean, there's something sort of inside that says, you know, this sort of rubs me the wrong way. But on the other hand, myself, I said, I think that the prize is worth the candle. I think we have to get management back. And I think the price is not too great. The amendment to the Constitution is not taking away the rights of free speech or the right to free assembly or the right to freedom of religion, free speech, or against unreasonable searches and seizures. As I've said before, if we sought to take away those rights, I would be among the first to the barricade. But this is not, at least in my view, but I know it isn't some, a major change to the Constitution. After all, the legislature has vast powers. It has powers over the exchequer. It has powers over state lands. And this is not a major leap giving the legislature more power. So, you know, with those thoughts in mind, I decided to support the task force proposal. And I urge you ladies and gentlemen to do the same. I think that overall, it's in the long-range best interest of the state, and I think it's vital that we regain management. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions, and there may be some others. I don't want to short anybody who is going to be testifying, but one of the things you have referred to repeatedly is the vastness of this and the vast management of capability of the federal government. There are some people in the state that think that's only half right. No, I won't. Anyway, I do have...
What's the other half?
They think it might be half vast.
I see.
Anyway, what I question I
you
do.
You mean the federal management?
Yes. The question I do have is that some people have indicated that we made a contract at statehood with the federal government, and that now, unilaterally with ANILCA and subsequently with other demands that may be coming from people within the current administration, that they are unilaterally changing that contract. And the question that has come up is that if we were to do this, if we were to modify our Constitution and quid pro quo something, how much assurance do we have as a state that they wouldn't renege again or continue to demand other things until we finally get it their way?
Look, we know the word of the United States is no good. We've had a judicial declaration of that not so long ago. It was that, again, was worth the price we now have it sort of indelibly in the federal books that the statehood compact was not really a compact at all. All of us who were here and voted for statehood thought a compact made a contract were wrong, disillusioned. I've always thought that if the United States, the day after statehood was proclaimed, it said, by the way, we're setting aside all these lands, we're taking them all back. I mean, this place would, the state would have been in an uproar. But, you know, the federal government and its, customary actions has managed to do over a period of time, which it could not have done, immediately. So we know it's no good. But here's the thing. I know that's a risk, but I have the sense that risk is not great. I have the sense that it's not great. And furthermore, you know, the constitutional amendment simply gives the legislature the power. And if it comes to a point when the United States wants to change the rules again, you simply say, well, I mean, we will repeal our legislation. You manage your lands, we'll manage ours, and life will go on. I mean, we're not bound to act pursuant to ANILCA's dictates, if you will, in perpetuity. We can back out of that deal anytime we want. And if the existing legislation is successful, then this legislature can simply repeal the ANILCA legislation, and we will be back to square one.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Ogden.
I think maybe Representative Bundy had a question first, but if I could get on the list, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I was on your point, I guess.
Oh, all right. I don't have any of those. Okay, Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. I think you used the term capitulate, which causes a lot of us some heartburn, and the creeping powers, and just related to Representative Green's concerns that, trust me, I'm here from the federal government, and that there is a concern that our only card in this game is the constitutional amendment. And I think the practical realities are, once we play that card, it's going to be very difficult. You said we could repeal it, we could take it back, but the chances of repealing a constitutional amendment are probably just as challenging as getting one, or even more so. And if I understood you correctly, you say that's all a possibility. We just sort of have to trust and go along. Is that?
Well, here's the thing. What's the downside of not regaining federal management now? I mean, if we don't regain management now, all the parade of horribles will come to pass. Now, do we want to accept that parade of horribles and say, look, you take it over, wind up managing exclusively fish and game in Alaska? We no longer has the chance ever within our lifetimes to get it back. It's gone. I mean, that's the option. I mean, that's a very real possibility. And so, recognizing that, do we want to, accept, in my view, you might say, in some respects, the lesser of evils, and regain management and keep our fingers crossed? because if they change the rules in the future, we're no worse off than if we did nothing. You know?
Just to briefly, very briefly continue, and regaining management to me says that we also deal with allocation, and it's been my concern that allocation issues would indeed be fought in federal court. So even though we thought we were managing, the ultimate management would still be in federal court. And you mentioned the fish upriver and the commercial fishermen in the ocean. In your opinion, would that not be fought out in federal court?
No. That would be within the powers of the Board of Fish. And the actions of the state boards would be given deference under the Stevens Amendments and the task force proposal. As administrative agencies of the state, when the issue was presented to the federal court. But here's one thing I think is important and should not be overlooked. It's one thing to be for the state to be totally out of compliance with the fundamental rural priority, which came in under the McDowell decision. It's another thing to say, well, we don't have the various, we haven't given the various rights to individual rural residents and they don't have their priority. Those are things that we can be corrected, you know, by administrative action. But as I've said before, and I want to make the point clear here, never will we be able to avoid the so-called federal court oversight. I mean, these are lands owned by the United States. Management of ANILCA is a statute of the United States, and the federal courts are always going to have the power to interpret and apply federal statutes. But I mean, after all, the United States owns these lands. I mean, it has the right to regulate the rights in those lands. And we aren't ever going to succeed in depriving the Congress of the United States of those rights, and we just have to face it. But I don't think that the risk, because there's going to be decisions in the federal courts under the statute, is such that it ought to restrain us from regaining management. We have to regain that. We have no choice but to regain management.
Just so that I understand very clearly, you feel that allocation issues that are decided by the board, while they would be fought in out in federal court, the board would have greater standing than whoever was bringing the complaint.
Yes, because that is the very thing, and as I say, it's highly important. It's contained in the Stevens Amendment. The state of Alaska in litigation sought to have the federal courts give deference to actions of the state board and fish and game. The Ninth Circuit said, no, we will only give that deference to federal agencies. We will not give that deference to state agencies. But the Stevens Amendments provide, task force and Stevens Amendments, provide that the federal courts must give deference to actions of the state agencies. And that means, you know, in a sense, in the vernacular, that the state agencies will have a leg up. Now, does that mean they can do anything they want? Of course not. They have to do, you know, quote, the right thing. They have to make reasoned decisions. But if they make those reasoned decisions and have a substantial basis for their decision, the federal courts are going to approve them. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Senator James?
Thank you. Well, Charlie, it's good to see you here today. We've talked a lot, haven't we?
Indeed. Thank you for your letter. I haven't responded to it, but...
Well, I didn't expect you to. I just have a few questions here. First of all, who owns the animals and the fish in the state of Alaska?
Well, let me tell you. I'm not sure that anybody knows that. But I know... regardless of who owns them, when they're roaming free, I'm not sure anybody owns them when they're running free, or if the fish is in the stream, or the animals are, you know, galloping across the tundra, because nobody is, you know, have dominion over them. Now, I've never really gone to the law review articles and, you know, tried to put my finger on that. But the fact of the matter is, in response to your question, when those animals are on federal lands, federal land, the federal government has that great concept of who owns them, because they can say, you can't shoot that animal. You can't take possession of that animal. You can't even come on our lands if we don't want you to. You know, they run the show, and they have the total and complete power to do that.
The next issue is totally different.
Representative James?
Yes, if I might. I've got another two more. Okay.
Well, there are several people.
I know.
Let's take your best shot first, and we'll move around and come back to you.
Go ahead.
Don't strike in my heart the first shot, though.
Representative Berkowitz.
I thought Representative Ogun was.
Okay, Representative Ogun. I have him after you, but.
Thank you, Representative Berkowitz. I'd like to make a couple of real brief statements about some of the things you said on the record and ask you a question. You said we'd regain state management, but in fact, we have to adopt the federal law, ANILCA, into our statutes and our constitution and adopt a federal form of management. And if we're out of compliance, the highly beneficial, I believe you used ANILCA amendments that Senator Stevens made one of them is, in accordance with Title 8 of this Act, the Secretary of Interior is required to manage fish and game for subsistence uses on all public lands in Alaska because of the failure of the state law to provide a rural preference. So it actually expanded the authority. It does not take effect until we adopt the Constitution or rural party in our Constitution, contrary to what Senator Stevens said on the floor. But I'll try to keep this brief. You're right, the word was no good. On the statehood compact. The main question I have is two things. Alaska Supreme Court said that the rural priority and the one basic fundamental right that you left out was equal protection. They said it was an equal protection case and an easy one as that at that. Is that a correct quote to the Alaska Supreme Court? And we also have the authority under the Article 8, Section 4 of the Constitution, the preferred or sustained yield, to give preferences amongst beneficial uses. And the beneficial use of fish and game can be subsistence. And so we can give a preference in times of shortage, sustained yield, for subsistence. And given that, we already have the authority to provide that discrimination and provide for that need. Is that not correct?
Well, that may be so, but we do not have the authority to grant priority to rural residents.
Because of equal protection.
No, because of the not equal protection clause, but because the common use provisions of the Constitution. That's where the Alaska Supreme Court hung its decision.
One follow-up on that point?
Representative Gogan, I've given you some deference now. If it's a discussion and you want some clarification of testimony, that's one thing. I don't want to get into a debate.
Yeah, I'd like some clarification.
All right.
But if I'm not mistaken, the Supreme Court did say that it was the rural priority case, the McDowell case, was an equal protection case and an easy one at that. Is that correct?
They mentioned that. But the proposed amendment would, you might say, trump the equal protection clause in this area.
Senator Berkley.
Thanks so much. General Cole?
Yes, sir.
You've read HB 406?
Yes.
Do you think it would prevent federal takeover?
It would not prevent federal takeover.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Cole.
Yes, sir.
One of the perhaps only consistent thing that I have been able to find in talking to people around the state is an agreement that in a time of shortage, most everyone would say a person who has customarily lived by that fish or game and depends on it for sustenance should have a priority in the time of a shortage. That may sound like a needs-based criteria, but maybe it's half a needs-based criteria, if you will. But did the task force dismiss that out of hand, or was there discussion about it, or what was?
No, we looked at that, discussed it at length. The problem is, you know, we're faced with the NILCA. We're faced with rural residents' priority. I, at least, and I don't speak, maybe Mr. Malott wants to comment, but I didn't think we could make a major change in that area. Now, you know, if you read the media now, I mean, I hear what Senator Stevens said yesterday. I've heard what Senator Murkowski has said. And if they're sending a signal that to the legislature that they can change ANILCA, and the fundamental precept of preference to rural residents, well, and, you know, you should perhaps take what I've said here today and, you know, give it the deep six, you know, and say, well, we're going to enact our own legislation. We're going to take the implication of what Senator Stevens, Senator Murkowski have said, that they can change ANILCA and the rural residents, and Secretary Babbitt will not seek to have it vetoed, and it can be fact accompli. That's a horse of a different color. And, you know, people were here in Washington, D.C., I should say, over the weekend, and you have the sense of, you know, what you were told. I don't have that. So all I am saying is that we're in the task force. We thought that you know, we couldn't change that. And it's true, as the Alaska Supreme Court said, rural residents is over-inclusive. You know, by that is there are people who live in rural areas who really don't live a subsistence lifestyle. And it's under-inclusive because there are people who live in other than rural areas who do essentially live subsistence lifestyle. So the Alaska Supreme Court says it's a bad fit. And in a sense, you know, we have constitutional restraints on us to require a better fit. Now, the United States does not have those constitutional restraints. No. So we looked at that carefully on the task force. Would you agree with that, Mr. Mullen?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Byron Malott, and I'd like to make two quick comments with respect to the discussion that's taken place thus far. First, in direct response to the question, during the task force deliberations, we were very circumspect and circumscribed in what we did. We determined that our role was to get federal management, state management back, as has been emphasized by Mr. Cole. And so that was a critical priority, and so we did not move far afield. We did look because Senator Murkowski, during the course of our deliberations, and I think in conjunction with Congressman Young, put at least the framework of a needs-based proposal on the table during that period. And we spent some time with it, but again, in keeping with that fundamental notion that we wanted to limit our task to doing two things, and they were clearly articulated at the outset, was to get state management back, to bring the state into compliance with ANILCA, and to recognize the importance and the subsistence priority to Alaskans, and to get that back. My other comment, Mr. Chair, and it's in response to the questions that have been asked, and I want to say this very carefully, but I think it's important, and I'm speaking not for myself. I will say this for myself. I'm proud to be a citizen of the United States. I'm proud that Alaska is among the 50 states of this union. I do not shrink from that in any way, shape, or form. I recognize the obligation we have in order to maintain our rights as a state within that federal framework, but I welcome the challenge when I consider what the alternatives might be. Secondly, I want to say that the same view that some share about the state-federal relationship exists with respect to the rural-state relationship, that there are folks out there right now, and I just came from the first meeting of the state of the Rural Governance Commission, and have spent considerable time on this subject of subsistence, when rural folks particularly Native folks, see a bill before the legislature to reduce rural educational funding and move it to urban areas. When there is a bill before the legislature to impose a tax only in rural areas, when rural people see legislation to impose mandatory governments in those areas, even though most involved probably recognize that that some of that legislation, you know, will not get passed. The very fact that they are there is very chilling to the relationship. And so you see rural people saying, we kind of like the idea of the federal government being out there to protect our interests if it comes to that. Having said that, there's also a very strong desire. It is almost universal. The theme of the next AFN convention to be held in October in Anchorage is celebrating the involvement and the pride of the Alaska Native people in defending their country, celebrating the Alaska National Guard, the history of the Alaska Territorial Guard, the involvement of the Alaska Natives in the military of this country. So there's a strong desire at the same time to be part of making Alaska work and, of course, being part of a country. And I say that because what we're doing here is not being done in a vacuum. That if, you know, AFN has not been at the table, AITC has not been here, RuralCAP, at least institutionally, and at some point I assume that they will make their views known. If they do not feel that those views have been made appropriately known here, they will take them to Washington. You know, they will make common cause with the Secretary of the Interior or with others. And that does not advance the process as your committee moves it forward and as the legislature continues to move it forward. Will be very inclusive of all of the interests and the institutions and ultimately the individuals that will be impacted by your decisions. And I know that that's your desire, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to emphasize it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative James.
Yeah, just one more question. This is for Charlie. And I have been reading Anelka a lot these days, and I've listened to Senator Stevens and his talk on this. And, you know, he pounds the table and said, the federal government has a right to do this for the Native people. I agree with that 100%. Then he turns around and like giving an excuse as to why this isn't a racial issue, which I don't consider Native and non-Native as a racial issue. It's Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, which is totally different than other races. And then says that 50% of the people included in this are non-Native. So why wouldn't the Anelka, if they want to do what it is that they're wanting to do, why don't they just go through Anelka and take out non-Native every time and just have be a rural Native preference? That would achieve the goal that was intended in the first place, and we wouldn't be having a problem today because Article 12 of our Constitution would allow us to implement that.
And a question?
Yes, please.
I don't know. I mean, Senator Stevens is there in Washington, D.C. Senator Murkowski is there in Washington, D.C. Representative Young is in there. But I've never heard them give that sense that they would. But my sense is, and I want to say this again, because I think it's vital to the deliberations of this group and the entire legislature. I don't think that certainly between now and December 1 or January 1, it is going to be possible to significantly amend the rural priority and Anelka. And I think we have to face it. And I think, you know, this 406 and 375 or whatever these bills are, I mean, I think, you know, they're not going to get there. I mean, we have to say if we're going to regain federal management, we have to comply with the requirements of Anelka to get it back. And I think the decision of this group and the entire legislature is, are we prepared to do it or we aren't? No. And if we ought to prepare to do it, we ought to bite the bullet and get it back and go from there. And if we're not prepared to do it, I think all these efforts to, you know, skirt around the skirts, if you will, of Anelka, it's just being divisive for the reasons that Mr. Malott said. I think it takes an incredible amount of time of this legislature and the people of this state. Nothing will, you know, get the job done unless we recognize and accept the rural priority requirements of Anilka and face it. Now, that's what I said in my letter. I mean, we either ought to just say, let's make the leap and do it, or we should wash our hands and say, let the federal governments take over. Except Senator Stevens and Senator Murkowski say that they can change Anilka as a fundamental rural priority. Maybe you want to take them up on that.
Thank you. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to kind of shift the focus a little bit and be a little more specific. And basically, I certainly directed to both of the witnesses, but most particularly to Mr. Cole, as it relates to the deliberations of the task force and looking at the history of Anilka. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that the current state statutory language on subsistence, the task force language, obviously, and then the existing House Bill 206, as well as Anilka with the Stevens changes, all assume that all species are of equal value when they're defining customary and traditional use and implementing the statutes the way it works. Now, that's there's the theory that it does that. I'd like your opinion on that, number one. And there is a theory also that the Congress especially declined to define customary and traditional historically because it would force a movement away from a case-by-case approach when looking at the scientific game management of particular species. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that's one of my major concerns, is because the task force recommended to Anilka that they amend and provide the definition of customary and traditional, which has been something, it's been a thorny issue for years. But I guess one of my major concerns is it does not provide for any discrete or any management of a discrete species vis-a-vis other species in terms of specificity. And I really am concerned about that right now, because I will be talking to this committee about what I would characterize as the, and it, what it means all things to all people. It means what I call the trout fish or the sport fish trout clause or amendment, because I don't think we have a differentiation in our definition running through all of these particular pieces of legislation that allows for that clearly enough to be able to do that. So if you could answer it on some of those.
So could he repeat that question?
I'd be happy to.
Let me see if I can give you a non-answer, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think that's something that we left to the boards of fish and the board of game. Because my sense is, although I don't recall this discussion vividly, but I mean, that's the sort of thing that we just thought we could not well legislate on. Did you have that same recollection, Mr. Millett?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, if I could interject, that's what Congress said before, and that's why they deferred and did not want to define customary and traditional. So, but then the task force went being further, though, by doing that.
We went a little ways because we thought that there was not a solid the definition in there, and there were other areas where there were not good definitions of rural itself. So we tried to, you might say, beef up Anilka just a little bit. And Senator Stevens went and passed those amendments for that reason.
Mr. Chairman, to avoid the Attorney General from asking or answering a non-question or non-answer, let me ask you this. Did the task force consider the problem is revolving around the definitions as related to the scientific management of discrete species?
I didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Millett, would you
Mr. Chairman, if I might just make a comment. This is Byron Millett.
Thank you.
I think being non-biologists, or at least non-professionals in this area, we hung our hats on the notion of sustained yield more than any other as we look at the policy implications of the management and recognition of discrete species. And as I indicated before, we were very reluctant to move very far beyond the existing management system, and the desire was to get management back. I just want to make a quick comment, and I think it's important to the question, that we also believe, I think intuitively, and I believe it very strongly, and have testified to this in an earlier hearing, is that if we can get the management system back working on the ground, as creaky and as difficult and as tough as that may be, we will at least then be dealing with discrete questions like this, as opposed to folks being in their corners throwing rocks at one another and not having any forum at the management level with which to deal with these issues.
Have either of you, to your knowledge, seen where there is any significant disagreement with the fact that that determination of sustainable yield would be determined by the Fish and Game Department, at least on the areas that the state has the authority? And the follow-up question that that's my assumption, and that we're really, when we're talking about a preference for subsistence, talking about that sliver of the yield that is just above that, as far as the priority that would be granted for subsistence use or lifestyle.
I'm not sure I understand the sliver just above it, but the fundamental proposition was that sustained yield remains inviolate,
mm-hmm.
and that's a provision that's in the proposed constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So that remains inviolate.
And the question was, do you know of any other movement or thought or plan that would not have that determined, whatever that may be for the specific location and the specific species? That would be determined by Fish and Game.
Yes.
What is the sustained yield? And that we're really talking about that that's above that as far as what would be utilized then for the subsistence preference.
Yes.
Okay. That's Chairman. Yeah, and we, on that issue we have several other people again.
Right. I just wanted to follow up here. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cole, and your persistent Attorney General, in looking at the Constitution, we have a mandate to look at sustained yield. But is there no allowance under a sustained yield definition to look at what I would call highest and best use of a species? For example, you can posit a lot of cases whereas the pick your type of use of a species would be different from sustained yield, maximum numerosity of harvestable fish and game. Example of this would be the catch and release, upper Cook Inlet, sport trap use vis-a-vis as the highest and best use vis-a-vis a subsistence take for that particular species. I mean, do you think that we would be, are we constitutionally allowed to manage for highest and best use versus vis-a-vis sustained yield?
Like I say, we have a constitutional mandate to protect sustained yield. I think what is done beyond sustained yield is up to the Board's of Fish and Game. But the fundamental principle is that sustained yield must be preserved. And then on top, you know, once you comply with sustained yield constitutional requirement, then under this proposal, we would essentially the first crack at the resource would be to the rural residents, and then on from there.
And I think, yeah, and I'm going to make a comment. I think where we may be coming in trouble, if you're talking like rainbow trout, not all those species in all the state would be considered a subsistence area, so that there would be places where the highest and best use may not be a subsistence area because it's not going to be a subsistence area. So I think that might help you in some of the concerns that you've expressed. Not everybody's. For every species, would
thank
be successful.
You for making me feel better, Mr.
On that point, Representative
yes, please.
Porter.
Maybe if I could ask it another way. Prior McDonald, Kanitsi, all that, it's my understanding that we managed subsistence by identifying stocks and types of animals that were traditionally used for subsistence. And rainbows probably weren't in there, except maybe some area that I'm not familiar with. Would you not think that the Kenai Kings and the rainbows at Alexander Creek could continue to be managed the way they are now under the task force proposal or any similar proposal that would provide a subsistence preference.
Isolated areas.
I would like to comment to this extent. I think that there was a recognition that there would be uses. I feel like someone.
Don't be intimidated.
That there would be uses that in discrete times and circumstances and for discrete species could have a higher and better use even than subsistence. Mm. And we, for example, recognized catch and release. We recognized the importance of other uses in the task force bill by mandating that on the regional boards there be folks from other areas, particularly recognizing sport uses. And there were even discussions or observations, I would say, and I think that I may have made one of them, was that if we ever got to the point, for example, where a stock were managed for trophy purposes on a catch and release or on some other highest and best use basis in addition to sustained yield, and that were challenged from a subsistence perspective, subsistence users would essentially be slicing their own throats because there's some places you just can't go in terms of committing an ultimate public policy outrage. And I think there was at least a general recognition of trying to put into place the ability for those kinds of things to be discussed and dealt with at the regional board level. There was a faint recognition with respect to catch and release. And again, I would say that those, from our perspective, were the kinds of issues that needed to be dealt with at the management and the discrete stock level, as opposed to in a piece of legislation.
Commissioner Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Hess, maybe I'm a little hypersensitive, but I'd like to respectfully disagree with earlier conversation or earlier testimony from Mr. Malott. And I sincerely hope that our discussions here will be predicated only on the subsistence issue and concerns about federal takeover of fish and game, and not on whether the state of Alaska has a right to expect rural residents to provide financial support for rural schools.
We appreciate your comment, Representative Bundy. Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I raised my hand to speak after Representative Ogun made his statement, and it's the vagaries of the way this goes around that it isn't very timely. Mm-hmm. But if I could just respond to that and then ask a question, because I looked up, as he was asking it, the wording he was talking about, the equal protection language, and it was from Justice Moore's concurring opinion. He was the sole member of the court to have that opinion. Three thought it was an equal access case, as the testifiers here said. Moore, apparently, not on the court anymore, thought it was an equal protection case. And Justice Rabinowitz, who's also not on the court anymore, thought it didn't violate either equal protection or equal access. I think it's important to clarify that. Representative Ogun, before he left, and he's back now, stated that it was an equal protection. That was not the majority decision. And in particular, when Representative Ogun was here before us testifying, he claimed that the governor dropped an equal protection case. And he and I have had a number of discussions about the fact that the governor did not. I copied the page of what was dropped in the Babbitt suit and have asked him a number of times to apologize for misrepresenting the governor. I hope he'll take the opportunity to do that here today. I wanted to ask, following up on Representative James's point, could Congress, if it got frustrated enough with us, simply enact the native preference that she was talking about on federal land? Is there any legal bar to them doing that?
Rob, thank you. I can't say, but I suspect not. I have the sense that given the broad powers of the United States under the property clause and under the clause dealing with the right to deal with the Indian tribes, that they probably have that power. I've never researched that point, but that's sort of my visceral feeling that I think they could probably do it.
Representative Berkowitz?
Just a brief follow-up on that point, and also consistent with federal powers, they could declare large tracts of their country Indian country, couldn't they?
Well, I had the thought, given Mr. Croft's, Representative Croft's question, they could just take vast areas of Alaska, I would imagine, and legislatively provide that they are reservation lands. And then we could deal with that Indian country issue again.
But with that shuddering thought, unless there are some very specific brief questions, we have several other people who have signed up to testify, and we're going to lose part of our quorum. Well, we'll lose part of our committee. I think we'll maintain a quorum.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly.
Representative Ogden, very briefly.
Ms. Cole, in Pollard's Lessee versus Hagen, which is a U.S. Supreme Court, it said that the shores, navigable waters, and soils under them were not granted by the Constitution to the United States, but reserved to the states respectively. Secondly, the new states have the same rights, sovereignty, and jurisdiction over the subject as the original states under the equal footing doctrine. And thus, the public trust lands are outside the scope of the property clause power. So the states do have the right to manage, and you did state that the animals don't belong to anybody because it's a public trust asset. And they don't belong to anybody until they're, I think, if I recall some of the core language, that skillfully captured, then yeah, it becomes property. And you're right, the federal government does have a right under the property clause to tell us, whether or not we can make access to that land, but they don't own the animals, and they can't say that we can't hunt them because of a certain specific, in my opinion at least, that because of where you live or any other, there's a difference there, isn't there?
Doesn't Kleppe address that?
Well, yes, A. Kleppe addresses that, number one, but the Court of Appeals has said in the Katie John case, look, under the reserved water rights doctrine, the United States has the right to regulate fishing in navigable waters within the state of Alaska. Until that case came along, everybody assumed that the federal government did not have any rights to regulate the taking, if you will of fish in navigable waters. But suddenly, out of deep left center field, the Court of Appeals said, look, the reserved water rights gives the United States that power. Once they get that power up there in that pink area, then they can, I think, clearly and easily extend the exercise of that power all the way down to the mouth of the Yukon. And that's what's terribly troubling. That's what's terribly troubling to me. And I think it should be the terribly troubling to everybody who has to touch with the fishing industry in this state, because I tell you, under that doctrine, it will not be long until the federal government will be regulating all fishing in the state of Alaska in all these waters. Navigable waters, non-contiguous to federal land. That's a horrible thought.
Just quickly.
Very quickly, because we have...
Yeah. I agree, by the way, and that's why we need to litigate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, because, and I understand that fear. I have that same fear that you do. My biggest fear is that we do a constitutional amendment that gets us in compliance, and they do it anyway.
Okay.
You know, it... That's my problem.
Well, thank how you. Do they do it anyway? I mean, we are then have rights and powers under the federal statute ourselves. We have rights under ANILCA. We have right to manage fish and game. We have the right to manage fishing in navigable waters. We sweep away that lousy Katie John decision if we regain management. Then we're control. Then we're making the rules. And Congress is not making the rules. I mean, that's my point. I mean, we've got to get it back. We have to swallow. I mean, it's not always easy to swallow, but we've got to regain that power. And then we can go from there.
I want to thank both of you for taking time out of your day to come in and talk to us about this, because it is a very contentious issue, and I really appreciate you taking the questions as well.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish you well.
Thank you. We're going to need it. Is Bob Penny online?
Yes, sir, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Bob, would you identify yourself for the record and give us your input?
Well, sir, I'm here. I'm not there because I'm here on a bread and butter item. My name is Bob Penny, and I'm co-chairman of the Last Together, and we have a formal group of our people there to testify. Mr. Chairman, have they all testified yet?
They have not yet. We're just getting into the Alaskans First or
together. Mr. Chairman, I very much respect and like to be able to come back after them, but I very much like the touch base and the question that somebody asked Charlie Bob about the Fed changing the status. That did not take place, and I'll explain that, if I may, when I come back on. Thank you very much.
Sure. Do I understand you want to go after the last person that's here with the group?
Yes, sir. There's a lot of people there taking a lot of time out of their day, have come a long ways to try and give testimony on something that's dear to their heart, and I think you should take the time to hear them. If I may, I would like to come back and address that, because I think I have a direct answer to that point. The statehood pact was not breached.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Penny, and there will be some people here that will be able to sit and listen to it all. Some will have to leave because of other commitments. But that then leads us to Jim Jensen, and I understand that you are going to introduce your group as they testify.
I can do that.
All right, thank you. Jim, would you identify yourself for the record? And
yes.
Have a seat.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Excuse me, one other thing before you get started. Would you prefer questions, if there are any, asked of each speaker or summarized at the end?
I think we're indifferent.
Okay, all right, good. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Jansen. I'm the president of the Linden Companies, and I'm pinch hitting today for Bob Penny, who sent his regrets that he couldn't be here today. And I didn't know you were on, Bob, and so what I'm going to suggest is rather than me providing both the opening introduction to Alaskans Together and the closing, maybe I'll ask Bob to do the closing. We can do that.
Whatever you say, sir.
First, I want to say we're here as friends with a common goal. And that goal is quite simple. We want to keep the feds from taking control of fish and game in Alaska. How we get there, we don't necessarily care, but we want to get there. And we think there's some high-risk ways to approach that, and there's some low-risk ways. Frankly, speaking for me individually, I'm not a real brave guy for the low-risk approach. Alaskans Together is quite a concoction of people from all over the state, probably every profession. We have sports hunters and fishermen, most of us are, a lot of businessmen, some native leaders, professionals, commercial fishermen, parents, concerned Alaskans, and mostly we're conservative voters. We're conservative supporters, so we're your friends.
I take no offense.
That's right, yes. You meant the collective
too.
We, yes, I understand.
He agrees with me a lot.
Thank you, Jeanette.
Go ahead, we get a little rowdy at times.
Personally, I'm an avid hunter and fisherman. I'm a businessman that depends on Alaska's resources for our business, the oil industry, mining business, commercial fishing. We haul a lot of fish. And we think this issue is an extremely important issue to our business. If the feds get control of our resources, we're in real trouble. We have enough problems now with the environmental movement. And if we lose this particular battle, I think it's going to be devastating to most of our businesses. I'm a father, kids. I want them to live the same wonderful outdoor life I've had with our hunting and fishing. I think it'd be totally different under federal control. Our role as Alaskans Together is to provide, raise money and provide funding to educate and inform the public. I'm distraught at how few people really understand the risks and the problems with the subsistence issue and the risks of federal takeovers. So we're going to put a lot of energy into informing the public. We're going to organize and distribute information. We're going to run polls. We'll provide that information to you. We're going to advertise aggressively. We're going to do speaking engagements. We're going to work with those in the legislature who really make this difficult decision. And we're going to work with you toward a common solution. We agree with Alaska's current governor and past four governors, the task force compromise plan. And I don't use the name governor's task force plan. If you pull up our ads on the internet, you're going to see that there's no picture of the governor, the lieutenant governor. And it's not a governor's task force plan anymore. This is a plan for Alaskans, states' rights plan, as far as I'm concerned. We agree with the congressional delegation. And we believe we agree with 85% of Alaskans who want to keep the feds out. I'm going to make my talk real short here because we have seven of our group, and I've kind of broke our talks down into seven specific areas. And Carl Brady will lead off with needs versus area plan.
Before you go, I have one question. I think I've been able to glean from what you've said that you are definitely in favor of keeping the feds out, as I think if 85%, I would certainly think it may even be higher than that. You have indicated that what you've seen so far would lead you to believe that the task force approach is probably the only thing that might be available to prevent federal takeover, as we've heard from General Cole and Byron Mallott, that they feel that. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm coming to is if there were another way to accomplish that, to keep the feds out, in fact, maybe even go beyond that, regain control of the lands and waters within the state, would your group support that as well?
I think we would if we believed it.
If you believed it, sure.
If it had a high probability of success. Mm-hmm. I think it's our general belief that some of the alternatives that we've heard have such a low possibility of success, and the stakes are so high, and the risks are so great, I think we're going to urge you to take the easy way. And being a businessman, I face decisions every day. I don't get the easy ones. I don't get the good solution versus the bad solution. I get the lesser of the bad options. And I'm afraid that's maybe what we have here. We're not terribly excited as a group about the task force plan, but it does keep the feds out. And me, for one, I'm not very brave. I'm not a risk taker.
Well, I just want to add, and I hope I speak for the committee, that your willingness as a group to go out to the public and help educate them and keep this thing so that we do come up with an Alaskan solution, I think is admirable. And I really want to thank you and your group for that. Attorney Brookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was pleased to hear Mr. Jensen's statement about working with us, and I just want to make sure that that's the position of his group, because, frankly, before we came down here and during the first part of the session, I didn't think that that was the case. I felt that your group was lobbying in support of the task force proposal only. They has rejected any further activity as far as trying to create another solution to this very important, difficult problem. And I think that's something that everybody that testifies from your group should be aware of. And I was just wondering if you thought that if the legislature was to come, were to be able to come up with a separate solution and allow that particular solution to go on the ballot of the primary election, and say perhaps along with the task force solution, what do you think your group would do? Would you lobby for a particular proposal, or would you be willing to be open enough to look at all solutions?
Well, I'm one member of our board. That certainly would take a lot of discussion of our group. But everything I hear amongst our group is that we want to keep an open mind. We want a solution. But we probably will be arguing with you if you put us into a situation that takes a high level of risk, because the stakes are too high. Some risks in life we don't take, like the lives of our kids. I think we're going to be very cautious. We're going to want to be very cautious about taking a risk that has a high probability of failure.
Say, I would follow up. That you put us in a real high position of risk.
You bet.
Well, let's keep an open mind now and right. Work as a group. You thank you, Jim. Do you want to introduce? I have a list here of people who have signed up.
If you'd handle that for me, I'd be very
okay.
Appreciative.
The first one then on needs, as you indicated, is Carl Brady.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, my name is Carl Brady. I'm a businessman in Anchorage and also a member of the committee that we're talking to. And I became involved in this, as so many others did, as a concerned citizen, because I saw a great big warning sign, and I misunderstood so much about what we're talking about today and the enormous job that you people have in front of you to accomplish. And through a great deal of work and education and expense, I think I've come to understand the issues, at least understand them much better than the majority of the people in Alaska do. It is a very misunderstood issue, but I think it's becoming a least misunderstood issue and heading towards a better understood issue. And through some of the work that all of us are going to work together, I hope cooperatively, to find the solutions that the public will understand and agree with the solutions that you folks are able to come up with. I do believe Secretary Babbitt. I do believe Senator Stevens. I do believe that there's a warning sign out there that says that December 1st that the federal government's going to act. I believe that because I believe they want to. I was here when they were here before. And I think that there's no perfect solution here. There's no perfect answer for anyone in this room on this issue. But in our efforts to understand what is before you and before the rest of us in the state and the opportunities we have and the problems that we may be faced, we've tried to together look at the situation on a basis of how it's been presented to us. And please don't take offense, because it's not been intended for you to from us, that we're trying to get out in front of a working body that has good intentions like we have. And I know it's a concern for everybody that we understand and communicate up front and fairly with each other. In getting to understand, because there's a bill, proposed legislation, and to understand it, we've taken different parts of this, and several of us are going to address those parts. And as Jim Jensen said, I was going to talk about the needs-based. The bottom line of this, short of a third pillar here of some other alternative, because if we don't do something and have a constitutional amendment, the way I understand it, and the federal government is going to take over, I hope your suit prevails. But that, in my mind, it's got some problems with it. I think it's a ways away, and after all the appeals, it's even further away. In the meantime, if the federal government comes in, they get better entrenched and further entrenched, I think it creates a further problem for us. I believe what Senator Stevens is saying, after 17 years on this issue, it's he's worked it very, very, very hard, and I believe he understands it. But we looked at the bill and proposed legislation and other things that we've heard, and we said, well, we let's take it piece by piece, and let's talk about those issues piece by piece. And I don't want to belabor this because most of you are very familiar. It all goes back to, is it in compliance with an ELCA? And simply, if it is not, I don't believe it's going to prevail. I think we have to do something together that will comply with ANILCA. And how we manage and tweak around after that may be the luxury that affords us to get really where we'd like to be someday. But rural versus income, I mean, in the bush, and let's admit, how do we define rural? Okay. maybe it's worked pretty good in the past. Maybe it hasn't been perfect, but you take a community like Dillingham, and they build a big school project out there. Well, there's a lot of work and a lot of jobs. A year later, the poor fishing season, no construction,
and we've got a different qualification for. So how do you establish a number, a level of income that says it's equitable if we're talking about the subsistence cutoff at some level, wherever you are, however much you make in rural Alaska? You're going to have economies. You've got a government community in Barrow, and you've got a different community somewhere else, and so it's going to be very difficult. And as people make money and fall off the qualification list, then the next year, if they're back on, they got to requalify somehow or another. And who's going to, and how are we going to pay for and administer the whole rolling cycle of this thing going up and down and coming and going as you may or may not qualify? I'm not finding fault. I'm trying to point out some of the concerns and problems that I think that we face. I do have a problem with the indication or implication that I've read that it looks like it becomes a welfare state of affairs. I believe it's going to be an administrative nightmare. I think it's a management nightmare. And I don't think it's realistic to say that in rural communities where subsistence style of life is the same for everyone and all, because there are families and communities that do have more income than others who share their subsistence with others within the community and share their boats or share their wealth to help buy boats and traps and nets and fish and fishing equipment. So having said that, I want to point out that these are my views. These are without counsel. It's my personal opinion. This group, to answer Representative Roepberg's initial question, I think, and a fair concern is it's going to take this body to act. It's going to take this body to act the way we would like to see it act, and so we don't want to be an adversary in any way, in any fashion. We are doing polling. We have done some polling, and we're going to share that information with each and every one of you in your own districts first before it's made public. And I think that's the proper thing to do. So with that, I'd like to, unless there's any questions, introduce Carl Mars.
We do have a couple, Carl.
Thanks very much. And kind of nice to finally meet you.
We met once, after the election.
Was that when you visited him in prison?
No.
It's clear now. I have a question, and I seem that you're focusing on the needs-based. It seems to me that one of the concerns that I have with the needs base is that it would be unconstitutional, in that with the McDowell decision, there was a determination that rural created a closed class. Now, it's easier for me to become a rural resident than it would be for me to qualify on a needs based. And I was wondering if perhaps you'd given that any thought.
I can't comment on the legal aspect of it, but from a social and a practical viewpoint, absolutely. Rural, in by definition, by many people in the lower 48, is somewhere outside of Kansas City where there's a lot of cows roaming around. Well, somewhere that far out of Anchorage is the Kenai Peninsula with some cows roaming around too. That's a very difficult question to define. But. There are more, it's overwhelmingly, in my opinion, more rural in outside of the major population we're talking about that live and depend upon a subsistence style of life as well as a cultural one. We are have an interest in a previous operated fishing lodge in outside of Dillingham up in the Wood River Tick-Chick State Park, and we have caretakers there, and we pay them a reasonably good salary, I think, but they have a subsistence style life, and it's from my experience with that, Representative Berkowitz, is that there's some real difficult work ahead on definitions and clarifications, and yes, qualifications aren't going to be perfect each and every time. But the alternative is much worse in the event that we don't find a third solution, which
I'd be love to find out what that is. I'd like to find five other solutions, and we could all agree on one of them, hopefully. But I believe that we're going to have, if we don't act the way we've discussed this, we're going to have the federal government in there, and I don't think any of us are going to like that.
You know, it's sort of ironic that you mentioned cow country outside of Kansas City. It's where my grandmother's family from, also named Brady, and they have no idea what rural really means up here.
Well, you're not, they're not alone.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Brady, and my thanks for you being here as well. You said something that resonated with me very well, because I always had this fear of doing something even if it's wrong, mentality that sometimes courses through Juneau. And you said, come December 1, the federal government will take over because they want to. And I know we have some problems up here in Glacier Bay because they want to control it and use it as a scientific center and remove human impact. My question for you is one that keeps bothering me a great deal, is even after constitutional amendment, what assurance do we have that the federal government wouldn't want to have even more until we have basically federal control?
I'll agree with you that we have very little assurance that they wouldn't want to continue. I believe they will, and unfortunately I see the courts leaning in those directions. I think, though, that that we, as Charlie Cole said, we have enough meat in ANILCA that I think that we've got enough protection. I can't interpret the law from a layman's point of view. We agree that the pacts, the compacts, the treaties, the agreements previously have not been honored. I believe there's been enough debate in Congress on ANILCA that they really want to see this thing go away after all of these years. And I think that I have to put my faith in the fact that if we had a constitutional amendment and we complied to the letter of the law with ANILCA, and we acted and managed and were proactive, I think we've got a sense of assurance that we'll be able to maintain our...
Senator Brookberg.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I want to really welcome Carl down here. It's good to see you, Carl. Ethan, I've known Mr. Brady for 40 years, I think, somewhere.
He doesn't look that old, Norm.
I know that. He doesn't, does he? But I was really pleased to hear your statements, Carl, about willing to work with us, because I want you to know that's what a lot of us are trying to do right now. And I did have a technical question. You indicated your relationship with the Wood River area. Do you think that a trophy Wood River rainbow should be subject to first priority subsistence use?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Representative James.
Thank you. thank you, Mr. Chairman. Playing on Representative Bundy's question about the federal government, what they want to do. And I've been observing the Interior Department for a long time, and I see an encroachment on our rights, not necessarily for the hunting and fishing, but to stop hunting and fishing. I mean, there's an environmental bent there that wants to leave animals alone. What kind of guarantee that once we get past this management of hunting and fishing, that they won't come in and do that sort of thing and even interfere with the subsistence that we're protecting?
Simple answer is none, but from a layman's point of view. I'm putting some faith in our legal system that is stronger than my personal agreement with your statement.